everyone out there, and welcome to today's episode of Women Seekers and Leaders, where every week we highlight amazing women in the pursuit of truth. These women inspire us to look beyond the known into the unknown and to see what can't yet be seen. I'm Serena Jettolina, your host, and I'm especially excited to bring you today's episode with my teacher, Dr. Jamie Stover Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt is a pioneer in the field of yoga therapy, the founder and director of Spanda Yoga Movement Therapy, and holds a doctorate of education in dance and movement studies. She currently serves on the International Association of Yoga Therapists Accreditation Committee and is the author of several books, including Every Woman's Yoga. In our heartfelt conversation today, we talk about her introduction to yoga at a very young age, the concept and practice of using your authentic voice, how yoga can benefit performers and artists, the meaning of Spanda and why it's important for everyone, how to allow for change and how to be comfortable with not knowing, what she would say to someone who believes they don't have anything valuable to add with their voice, and more.
And Dr. Schmidt, you're also a voice teacher, a vocal coach, yes?
That's right, yeah. I used to be on the faculty at Westminster Choir College, part of Rider in New Jersey.
Fantastic. So I'm looking forward to hearing you speak about maybe the close relationship between the singing aspect, the more gross aspect of finding your voice, and the more internal or subtle aspect of finding your voice, and how the two correlate. So to start, welcome and thank you for being here with us. How did you begin practicing yoga?
Well, my mother wanted to take a yoga class when I was about 5 years old at the YMCA in my town, and she didn't have a babysitter that night. And so the teacher made her promise if I would be quiet, I could come along. And so I went, and I loved it, and I was very quiet. And my mother eventually got busy and started doing other things, but I kept training with the same teacher. Her name was Margaret Hill, until I graduated from high school.
And from there, how did that develop into Alexander technique, body-mind centering, singing, yoga therapy?
Yeah, it's interesting to me that when I went to college, I found myself in a school that had a really fantastic dance program. And I just took a few classes, and it turned out that I was pretty good at it. And people were saying, well, you haven't been taking ballet. You weren't a baby in ballet. How is this possible? And I attributed that to yoga, because not only do you gain a lot of flexibility and strength, but you really get well coordinated. It's a really holistic practice that works with every part of you. So I was able to join a modern dance company like my freshman year of college, just pretty much from studying yoga. Yeah.
That's impressive.
So that's how that came into being. And then the dance world opened up to me, and I was interested in the arts and in film and all kinds of things. But the body and movement and yoga was just the most interesting. And yoga was the umbrella for everything. Everything fit into yoga. I could see a place for everything because yoga is so big and it could hold everything.
When did the voice become a focal point for you? When did singing crop up or arise as part of your practice?
Voice became a part when I was invited to teach at Westminster Choir College in their sort of for professionals, adult education, music professional program. And they had me just come in as an Alexander technique teacher. I had studied with Eileen Crow, who's a master teacher and one of my main mentors. And so I came in as an Alexander teacher, and it was a very popular thing. And I started to develop other aspects than Alexander. And I started to work with the body, and mostly with singers, to help them use their whole body in singing. And I started to develop a type of hands-on work for people while they were singing to help them find their alignment and to find greater ease and to use their breath from the yogic background and to feel their support, and started to develop movement practices for singers and work with a really excellent vocal coach, Laura Brooks Rice and others as well. We never really called it a particular method, but it was very popular and very active because people really did sound better when they embodied themselves more fully. And it was really a lot of fun.
I'm imagining and I can picture, you know, the hands-on adjustments and assists that would happen as someone is singing. Would you say that there was an energetic connection, and was that something that you were tracking or feeling as you were making these hands-on assists as people were singing?
I think that's a really good way to think about it. I think one of the most fun parts of that was to help people activate in their body. So we would do something like a push hands exercise from Tai Chi, where we would have people push against us and sing while they were pushing. So people would be singing these marvelous arias, but at the same time, they'd be digging their heels in and really trying to like shove a piano up a hill or something like that. So it was ironic, but it was also amazing because they could feel their pelvic floor and they could feel their diaphragm and they could feel their blood beat, you know, pulsing through their veins. And it really was energizing and just exactly what they wanted to find. And sometimes, you know, performance anxiety is a big thing. And no more so than in your voice. You can hear it in your voice. Your voice will crack or your vocal range won't be completely there because of your nerves. It's a pretty obvious tell. And so to really activate in the body and find ways, we'd have people bouncing on big physio balls and singing and, you know, really just doing all sorts of physical things to, you know, really include their whole body in their sound. And it was really, really fun and very, very beneficial.
It sounds like a lot of fun. From those practices, could you see the people that you were working with not only develop in their singing practice, but, you know, through their own embodiment of themselves, through that voice, could you see them light up in other ways or embody other aspects of their being from those practices?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I think in performance, I think what makes maybe a good performer a great performer is this kind of idea, well, they would say the idea of vulnerability or honesty. And sometimes people hide, especially if they're good technicians. They can hide behind their technique and put on sort of a body attitude of, I'm a great opera singer or whatever it might be. But I think when you really are embodied, and just like in your asana practice or, you know, in an athletic event, unless you are really fully committed to the movement you are doing, you're not going to get that ball in that hoop, or you're not going to meet that, you know, tennis ball with your racket. You really have to go for it. So I think that really helped people be honest in their singing and in their performance and in their vulnerability. And so that honesty can't do anything but be part of who you become, I think, as an artist. And I think it's what people look for when they, you know, go to experience art. It's what we relate to in another person.
Well, and I think that that point of vulnerability and honesty is what, as a yoga teacher and as yoga students, are constantly looking for. When you are teaching, you know, finding that line of what is my voice versus who am I emulating? How do you get to that place of honesty so that your students feel that and then you can pass along that same honesty toward them? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that come to mind and that I was told when I was training to be a yoga teacher way back at the dawn of time was to teach from your experience, to teach from your experience of your own practice. I think that everyone does the same pose, or we all do a certain range of similar poses, and there's a commonality to that. But I think what we experience while we're doing our practice is uniquely our own, and there are certainly, again, our commonalities. But on a particular day, something might occur to us that didn't occur you know, to anyone ever before, or didn't occur to us before. And so we see something in a brand new way, and it's exciting, and it's filled with promise, and we're curious. And when we're curious, we're most alive, I think. We're living in kind of this state of discovery. And so we bring that, we can take those experiences and we can bring them into our teaching. We can say, oh, you know, when I was standing on my right leg this morning, I noticed that if I bend my knee this way, I have this experience. And if I straighten my knee, I have that. And I do think that, you know, people who have like a whole method of something, I think they're teaching maybe an entire pathway of discovery. Like, I've been working with fascia lately, and I've been working with more than fascia, but it's come to the foreground. And so I've been able to take a lot of the different things that I've learned and apply them to this kind of way that I'm working, multidimensionality and movement and near and far reach and issues of initiation and different things that have come from all these different vocabularies. And it's sort of like a gem that I'm just looking at and I'm fascinated by, and I can hardly stop playing with it because it's so interesting and beautiful and riveting in a way. So I think when we find these places in our practice or in what we're interested in, we should feel okay about discovering, you know, working on discovering them and then sharing that with our students, even if it isn't something we learned in our training, even if it isn't, you know, something we found in a book or at a conference on yoga, that it's okay to do that.
Well, and that fits in with vulnerability in our culture, and especially, you know, as yoga teachers, we're always looking toward the next training that I can get and the next certification and the next piece of paper and appearing as that expert and needing to be that expert. And curiosity goes back to a beginner's mind. Mm-hmm. It's saying, here I am and I've never been here before. And how do I approach that with vulnerability of not knowing and with the curiosity of honesty and openness and seeing what arises? And in that process of finding one's voice, again, we're back to, as you learn, there's a point of emulating your teacher or those that you respect and admire, and then growing into who you are as a teacher, who you are as a person. And you mentioned practice, and it's one of the most important things that we say when looking for a teacher is find the teacher who's actually practicing and what comes from that. And what else would you say helps, not just practice, but in the process of that in-between time where you're just kind of stuck and you're like, well, you know, my teacher says this and I'm going to say it because it resonates with me, but it's also not quite the thing.
Well, I think that is a very good thing to do. I just want to acknowledge that, to teach what you know and what you were taught, and keep discovering on your own. I also think that some amount of self-inquiry can be really useful. One of the things that I share with our teachers, our trainees who are learning to be yoga teachers, is to kind of consider teachers that they've experienced in their lives. They don't have to be yoga teachers. They might be. And think, what worked about that? You know, you might have a teacher from some part of your education, high school or college, or maybe just like your music teacher that you really were inspired by. What did they do? What was actually operating when they were, you know, working with you as a student? And consider what those characteristics might be. And also, in line with that, what do you value in learning or just in life? Like, what's important to you? So I think thinking about those things and bringing them kind of consciously into the foreground, so that you can, even in the smallest little thing of a you know, early morning yoga class or a class just that meets once a week, that you can create an environment for people, create the world that you want to live in your yoga class.
What would you say as a response to how that curious nature can get shut down by the expectation of needing to know everything and needing to be the expert, and how that can shut down your authentic voice as a teacher.
I think that's a really good point to make. And Serena, and I think that, again, just standing in our vulnerability and being honest, nobody does know everything, and keeping curiosity open so that if I don't know it, I will search for the answer. I had a teacher, I still have a teacher, her name is Shivarpita Joan Harrigan, and she is extraordinary, and she knows volumes. But if you ask her something, because she's honest, she won't fake it. She won't make it up. But she'll say, now I haven't considered that. Let me find out. And she will just be right there with her unknowingness in that moment, and she will find out. And I think that honesty creates a certain level of trustworthiness in someone. You know that they're really going to tell you it straight. And I think trustworthiness is a really important part of teaching. And it also allows the students, if you model your humanness, then students can see that it's really okay to be just exactly who and where they are. And I think modeling that is a really good way to be given permission to do that yourself.
There is a very liberating experience when you are around a teacher who is comfortable in not knowing, and who is comfortable in the exploration. And it does free up. You can feel in a room the difference, because then the students don't necessarily feel that same expectation placed on them to be doing the pose exactly the way, or breathing exactly the way they're supposed to.
Yeah, and I think it makes room. You know, it makes room for inspiration. It makes room for the thing that we all know that we really are, to speak. If I can get myself out of the way, and then I can just be in the moment of that question, the answer might actually arise from my experience, not from my book learning or from some, you know, thing that I've trained in or studied. But it might just come right out of my body. It might come out of the student's body. We might together be riding the same wave, and we'll discover the same message in that bottle. And I mean, those are very rare and precious moments, but they do happen in teaching. And I do think the idea of vulnerability and honesty set the stage for that, allow that to happen.
Let's go a little bit deeper into that natural voice or authentic voice arising that doesn't come from a book and doesn't come from something we've learned. Or what would you say that thing is, or how does that feel?
Well, the framework that I hold, although I'm sure there's lots of frameworks to hold that, for me, it feels like the inner guide or the divine within has taken the mic and is taken over. And that's the goal for me, anyway, of yoga. So I named my school Spanda, and Spanda means vibration, but it also has this idea of creativity and of eventuality of the divine mother, in a sense, coming into form, something coming into form that was heretofore unformed. So creativity, this birth of something, anything happening and coming into three-dimensional form. I think that, again, in meditation and in art, in performance, we practice, we do what we can to create conditions, but that kind of moment of creation is not something we can control. And we have to be open to that. There's like a state of openness for that. And we strive for that.
Jamie or Dr. Schmidt, I'm wondering, how the preconceived notions that we have, how the societal influences, the external spheres that surround us, how those things both build up our own inner voice and both tear down or are detrimental to our inner voice. And, you know, I'm thinking of the phrase like, children should be seen and not heard, or, you know, I grew up in Texas and there's a strong culture of, you know, women being very powerful, but also demurring and not speaking oftentimes. And I'm not criticizing that at all, but I'm simply bringing the point of, you know, sometimes these things resonate with our inner voice and sometimes they don't. And picking apart which of those external influences feed us or don't feed us can be difficult sometimes. Do you have any advice on how to parse through that?
I think it's really up for us in our world right now. And I think it's really up for women in the world right now. I think, you know, the phrase speaking truth to power is an act of fierce bravery. And I think speaking one's own truth and being vulnerable is actually a tremendous act of bravery. It's much more challenging to be vulnerable than it is to be aggressive or shut down or, you know, overly kind of pedantic or forceful. Much more challenging and takes much greater courage to be open to see if things are going to be okay and to allow for creativity to occur. And I think that, you know, position of allowing and nurturing and creating conditions for the unknown to have a say or to have a presence is something that I would be willing to fiercely defend. But I do think there is some forces that are in play and have been in play for many, many decades, that many centuries really, that find that sense of vulnerability, that sense of openness threatening in some way for whatever various reasons. And I see that played out on the national scale. I see that played out on the world scale. You know, every night on my news program that I watch, and I can see that influencing the decisions a yoga teacher might make in how they present and how they stick to the script or relate to students. But I do think that these moments of openness are really when healing happens, when growth happens, when learning happens, when the connection that we all really desperately need, especially in this technological world, in this opioid-infested country that we're in right now, I think we're looking, actually, for that state of vulnerability. I think we're looking for that thing that happens when we are open.
It makes me think again of you talking about Spanda and the pulsation, and where we first began when you're talking about feeling vibration and working with vibration. And all around us, I mean, sound is vibration. And when we quiet the mind, when we go inside and there's a proprioceptive awareness and an interoceptive awareness, you can feel the vibrations in the body. You mentioned connection and disconnection. And I'm wondering how that blend of silence and paying attention to the felt sensation of vibration or sounds, I know that you do sound therapy too, how paying attention to the felt sensations of sound can be internalized to aid in the process of then our own authentic vibration or resonance arising out of us as voice?
I think that yoga has an entire you know, field within itself on sound, several actually, Asvara Yoga and all the various forms of pranayama and then the chanting and mantra and the study of vibration. I think the idea mainly that I like to hold when I work in this realm of vibration and of sound is this matrical sort of net, you might say, like the image is sometimes given of Indra's net that is the matrix of everything that can be seen or felt or heard or sensed in any way. And that this net is the ground substance of all things. So when we work with vibration from ancient traditions like yoga that have mantra and very specific organizations of sound through the palate, through the body, in the space around us. You know, there are other sacred languages as well, like Hebrew and others. We can have experiences that are, you know, unitive and that resonate in certain kind of frequencies. And this starts to sound kind of like, it starts to become difficult to talk about in a way, but the fact is that these are real, and sound is real, we all know that, and vibration is real, and the kinds of explorations that one can do with vibration and frequencies are very subtle and can be very profound, especially in the process of healing. One exercise that I really like and that anybody can do, and you don't need to know anything about sound or mantra or be a singer or a musician or anything like that, is to kind of sound into different areas of your body. So when singers sing, they try to get resonance in their head or, you know, using the sinuses or the forehead or whatnot. But to kind of explore making sounds with your voice that resonate different areas of your body. So you might think lower tones would resonate lower in the body, and that tends to be true, or higher tones in the top of the head. But even to sound, thinking of an organ like the liver. Liver's pretty obvious. It's on the right side at the bottom of your ribs. And putting your hand or hands there and taking a deep breath in and just making different tones and seeing where you actually feel that organ vibrating. It's pretty terrific to find the right note that will really make a connection to a different organ. So this is a really simple, straightforward experiment somebody could do to just start to play with the idea of vibration and get a sense that that vibrational healing is a thing and it can be really valuable.
Where does the habit of sing-songy yoga teacher voice come from? Let's talk about that for a minute.
I don't know. I wonder. I know when we studied the vagal tone, we talked about the ventral vagal and the dorsal vagal. Ventral vagal being more of like the happy-go-lucky, rest and digest, social interaction part of us that helps us to bond with people in groups. And when we explored that with Kimberly McKeever, who's a body mind centering teacher and practitioner, she had us, if you remember, call our pets. Like if you were to call your pet or I were to call my pet, my pet call sounds like this: Sophie, honey. And it's that kind of high voice that bonds us to something that we love. So maybe it's just some kind of
a bonding mechanism. Yeah. Well, and isn't it true that, I mean, babies will respond to the higher pitched and the kind of doting sound.
Yeah, and we do that to be non-threatening, I guess, you know. I don't know.
It's an interesting way to command authority in a room, but
where do you think it's from? Do you have a thought on that?
I think it's, one, a learned behavior. Uh-huh. We hear it. And two, I think that there's a preconceived notion that yoga teachers should speak in a calming or relaxing voice, and that a calming and relaxing voice sounds like a particular thing that is drawn out into a song. And then all of a sudden you've lost your actual tone. Mm. And, you know, possibly then you've lost your connection to that center inside of you because you're out of frequency with your natural resonance.
That's interesting. I think for me, not just the tone, but sometimes I hear people say things. I mean, they might be popular, like this year it's about sending energy up from your arches or something like that. I remember one time Gwyneth Paltrow talking about, and I think she really could feel this, that she was having trouble with her back bends because her kidneys were tight. So people were talking about that and these kinds of things. But I really strongly feel that imagery really needs and is most useful when it arises from an experience that's true, and when it arises from anatomy. So if I were to say, everyone, like, let your lungs be like balloons and drift to the sky. I mean, I guess that would work. But if I were to really think about the lungs are actually pretty full of blood, and they're fairly dense, and they're pretty heavy. So if I were going to, I mentioned pushing a piano up a hill before, if I were to really like want to feel substantial in my sound, I might sense my lungs as a kind of like a voluminous, dense, kind of important, substantial part of me. And what if I spoke from my lungs in that way, instead of as if they were little balloons, that I could speak from them as if they were close to my heart, held my heart, and had substance. You know, what would that sound like? You know, so anyway, I think that relates in a way to the voicing as well. Like, what is the experience that you're having? What sound goes with that? Like, how do you speak when you are maybe pulling energy up from your whatever, or you are bending backwards and feeling the widening of the back of your heart? Like, what do you sound like when you actually are feeling that? I think people would resonate with that.
I think they would too. It reminds me of a practice that a teacher has given me and other students before, of taking certain postures and speaking from that posture, mm-hmm. and pulling breath up from different places or power up from different places. Mm-hmm. But it also makes me think of, you mentioned context of what voice are you using in a certain scenario or situation. You know, I think of a child who wants a piece of candy and maybe goes to mom and asks mom, and mom says no, and then goes to dad and asks dad in a different voice or, you know, a different tone. And, you know, maybe the dad says yes this time. But we learn the responses that we get from other people. And we do use different voices, just like we have different faces for different people that we're around and groups and places that we're around. And I think that's the whole crux of it, is are we piecing ourselves out into too many disparate persons or personalities? Or are those simply authentic manifestations of a very complex human being? You know, what is that balance of those bits and pieces?
You know, for me, what comes to mind when you say that is the idea of safety. One of my teachers, Dr. Ballantyne, Rudolph Ballantyne, when I would talk about, you know, safety and whether I was bonding or defending in a certain, you know, environment, he would kind of do this wonderful yogic thing and go, well, what is you? Who are you that you need to defend? And that really kind of stuck with me. He would be like, well, if you're not really there, if you're particles and waves in space, what does it matter? And that really kind of, you know, snapped me out of that idea. So I guess safety is also relative. Like, can I experiment? Everything is an experiment. So can I experiment with trying out behaviors that I might not imagine were going to be you know, were going to go well. Oh, I need to have this voice in this context because that's what everyone else seems to be doing in this context. But what if I were to say, well, let me try this and see how it goes. And it might be surprising. And it might be, everyone might be refreshed by it. And it might not go well too. But if my locus of safety is me, then I'm okay with it. You know, and again, like we keep both circling around this idea of vulnerability. Like Eileen Crow used to say, if you're going to be wrong, be loud and wrong. If you're going to miss a note, really miss it. Like, just go for it. What's the harm in that? Like, you just fall flat and then you get up and you go, that was funny. You know, is this thing on? And you just keep going. So I think there's something about that preciousness that we can get so walled in our idea of what we think is real or what's going to happen. And if we just can like let it go a little bit and fail for what we think or try something that we think isn't going to maybe go well. And of course, I'm not saying just do it on purpose, but be wrong on purpose. But I think that freedom of experimentation can be really helpful with that.
The freedom to not be right. And again, coming back away from, you don't have to be the master. You don't have to have all the right answers. You don't have to have, you know, 50 certifications. And it's absolutely fantastic if you do, mm-hmm. but, you know, without...
I do.
Right.
You do.
Without the experience, right. Without the integration...
Right.
What do you really have?
That's right.
50 pieces of paper.
That's right. Yes, that's right. I mean, I think even just talking about yoga therapy for a second, and IAYT, their standards for yoga therapists, one of the biggest newer ideas that they're trying to, it's not a new idea, it's an old idea, but they're trying to articulate it more, is this idea of integration, that there has to be a vision to a program, that there has to be a unifying kind of, integration, vision that holds all the pieces together. And I think as we do our practice, we stay open. You know, we figure out through that practice, what are we interested in? What are we curious about? That will unify. It's like a unifier. Then it's like, oh, well, I'm interested in this, not so much that. I mean, yes, I'm interested in everything, but maybe it's a time thing. Right now, I'm interested in this. So these things will hang together for me, and those people will find me. And then maybe 10 years from now, I'll be interested in something else, and that will hang together. And those people will find me, and I'll find them. And we'll just keep, you know, moving along that way.
And would you say that does our voice change as we change? And I'm not talking about tone, you know. I mean, because we change every second, every day, 10 years. You know, what we're interested in and, you know, how to allow for the opportunity to change too.
I think that's a beautiful question. I go back to singers now and I think of, well, I mean, it's kind of like almost, you know, too obvious, but I have friends who sit and listen to Frank Sinatra and they can pinpoint pretty much like which 6 months of his life his voice is from. Because his voice, you can hear the very young Frank, middle Frank, older Frank. And that's true for many singers. You can hear and it's rich all the way through. And sometimes even better towards the end even, you know. So I think there's a recognizable part that's always there. But then I think that we have elements that do kind of like a spectrum. They go from one element to the next and we can allow that to happen. And that's just part of growing, I think.
Jamie, any final thoughts on, I don't want to call it the struggle, but sometimes it is a struggle. Any final thoughts on how to move ourselves, move our masks, the veils, out of the way, to lift the veils to what truly lies behind us and inside of us?
Well, I think I know it sounds kind of funny, but to say to trust. I mean, to trust means there's something that's, you don't know, like to step into the unknown with faith, or to step into the unknown and just trust.
Jamie, what would you say to someone who believes that they don't have anything valuable to add?
I can hear one of my teachers saying, do your practice. All the answers lie in your practice. And I think that's true. I think if you listen to your body, it will teach you what you need to know. I often say when I teach a class, your body is the teacher. I'm just the tour guide. And I think that whatever our body is, or whatever our body conveys from whatever other place it may be from, if we listen, if we pay attention, we will know, because the body doesn't lie. It can't.
Well, this has been an interesting and really great conversation. Thank you.
Thank
you for joining us. And thank you for using your voice.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who joined us today. I sincerely hope that you enjoyed the conversation between Jamie and I. I'd love to hear any reflections or questions you might have about the conversation, or suggestions for who you'd like to hear on the next episode. You can write to us at wsl@yogainternational.com. Please join us for next week's episode, where we'll be speaking with Stephanie Lopez, who is a senior iRest Yoga Nidra trainer and teacher. Until then, wishing you inspiration and clarity on your own journey toward the truth.